On this episode, we discuss Doolittle.
Why do they call him Doolittle? I think he does a lot in this movie.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
And it was what Audrey predicted was going to be the gag.
That is the exact thing I have written in my notes to say, Stu, for this part. Oh, two peas in a pod.
Everyone, and welcome to the Flophouse. I'm Dan McCoy.
Oh, hey there. I'm Stuart Wellington.
Top of the morning, or whenever you're listening to this. Midnight? I don't know. I'm Elliot Kalin. And Dan,
hey,
who's joining us?
Yeah,
or
Dan.
Stuart? Or Dan?
I
or
thought
Stuart?
We decided on Stuart, but I can say it. It's David Sims of the Blank Check podcast, and he is the film reviewer for The Atlantic.
That is a
big... high-toned magazine. That is a respected mm-hmm. publication.
That's a two monocle
Elliot.
Magazine.
That's just called glasses, Stu.
Oh, what?
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me. Yes, I did. I did poop all over Doolittle in the hallowed pages of The Atlantic, which was founded by Ralph Waldo Emerson and people like that.
I mean, it took
so
a such a
that.
It took such a brave stand against slavery. Before right. and during the Civil War, and now you've continued that tradition by taking a brave stand against Doolittle.
Exactly.
I mean, I thought it was a... I mean, I think it's kind of the Pixies' best album, right?
That was another of the jokes that I was going to make, so we've all round-robined each other's jokes.
It's not my favorite, but it's probably their most accomplished.
You're a Surfer Rosa man, I assume?
No, I was, what, because of the nudity on the cover, Dan? The answer was when I was a kid, yeah.
Now, I don't know the band The Pixies particularly well, so I'm just going to assume they have an album called Out the Door, Through the Window, out of the line in It's a Wonderful Life, where he says, out you two pixies go, out the door, through the window. And I'm going to say, that's my favorite album. Do they have that? Is that a real thing?
I'm going to go check Metal Archives and see if it's listed.
I mean, The Pixies are on Metal Archives?
Actually, no results found, so no, I guess not.
Okay. 80s alt-rock not heavily influenced by Frank Capra, I guess.
That's disappointing. That's very disappointing. But you know that punk was, because John Doe, major punk figure, named himself, I assume, after the Capra movie, Meet John Doe.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool.
I have to assume, if I ever meet him, I'll be like... Meet John Doe, like the movie, and he'll laugh and laugh.
Yeah, so normally if you're just tuning in, you're thinking this is an alternative music podcast. But no, in fact...
With
we're...
four experts.
But no, in fact, we're a movie podcast, and we watched a movie, and now we're about to talk about it. And
what
kind
of movies
did we watch?
What kind of movies do we usually watch, Stu?
You know, we kind of run the gamut. Sometimes they're comedies... Almost always, they're moving images with sound attached.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very fair. Very rarely do we watch a silent painting and then review it.
Or a silent movie. We've never watched a silent movie. Or Mel Brooks's silent movie. So
yeah. Or The Artist, the best picture winner I consistently forget existed. Which is a mostly silent movie.
Now, guys, was that a French movie? Because I feel like when Parasite came out, they're like, first foreign film to win the Oscar.
This is a good point. I believe The Artist is technically a French movie. Although,
I think that it has American actors in it, like John Goodman is in it. But I think what they were saying a lot of
John
was first foreign.
John Goodman's in Parasite?
John Goodman plays, he plays the, he's, you know the guy who's in The Host and Parasite and Snowpiercer?
Uh-huh.
That's John Goodman.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow. What
yeah,
range?
Yeah. He's in the makeup chair for hours and hours. It's highly offensive. No, I think that what they were saying a lot was first foreign language film to win the Oscar.
It seems like a weird hair splitting to me, honestly, but...
I mean, to be honest, they probably forgot that The Artist existed.
Yeah, that's probably right.
As I consistently do every time I look up past Best Picture winners, and I'm like, oh yeah, The Artist. Oh yeah. Yeah, and they used the soundtrack from Vertigo in it. Kim Novak got all mad. Yeah, yeah, sure, The Artist, yeah.
Yeah, I just spit coffee all over my office wall, imagining John Goodman being transformed magically into Kang Ho Song.
So,
I mean, it would take magic. It would take a spell of some kind or a cloak of disguise. So what movie?
Is...
Yeah.
No, I just to finish the thing that you teed up for Stuart, but he deliberately he zagged on you. We normally watch bad movies, and then we talk about them. And this week we watched Doolittle.
Now, guys, Doolittle, of course, as you all know, is a new adaptation of the classic story of Dr. Doolittle, the man who could talk to animals. And I just want to say, forewarning, this is going to be a slightly awkward episode for me because I know someone who was involved in the making of Doolittle. I know actually one person, one of the screenwriters, and one animal. And I brought the animal with me just to, like, make sure it's okay with everybody. So if you look on your screen, you'll see there's a tiny raccoon right there.
Oh, wow. Hold on. Let me take a
picture.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know
we
were getting two guests.
I didn't know we were going to have a celebrity for the...
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, was that Catherine Deneuve played the raccoon? I can't remember.
Yeah. Well, actually...
They really brought
them
all in.
This is... This is Rick Raccoon. He used to be Ranger Rick, but he was drummed out of the force, of course.
Yeah, I'd rather not talk about it, how I was once a park ranger and then was dismissed for causes that I would call unsubstantiated allegations.
That's fair. Now your father was, of course, the famous Rocky Raccoon.
Yeah, the Beatles wrote a song about him. It was called Love Me Do.
Now, Rick, you were in Doolittle.
Yes.
Jesus. But I don't remember seeing a raccoon in the movie.
No, they cut all my scenes.
Oh, why did they do that?
Well, there was a whole subplot about a raccoon that wanted to be a famous chef, and they thought it was too close to Ratatouille, and I was like, Ratatouille's about a rat, but I'm a raccoon.
And, well, I gotta say, I totally understand the point they made, but what was it like being on the set of Doolittle?
Jesus
oh,
God.
Wow. I mean, the craziest thing was I was the only real animal in the whole movie. The rest was all computer animated. So it was just me and Bobby Downs, that's what I call Robert Downey Jr., just looking at a bunch of tennis balls and pretending there was like gorillas or ostriches or whatever there.
And who's going to be your celebrity voice when it was finally dubbed?
Oh, Catherine Deneuve, just like Mr. Sims said.
Oh, okay. Wow. So do you have any funny behind-the-scenes stories about...
No, he doesn't have anything funny about it. Nothing is funny about this at all.
Dan, if I could talk, please. Dan, if I could speak, please. Dan, you had your time. Now let me have my time. Excuse me. Excuse me, sir.
Okay.
Now, for the audience at home, I do have a tiny puppet on my finger and a raccoon.
To mention is somehow it's more annoying than if he was just doing the voice that he has a puppet on his finger that he is continuing to move around as he talks.
You know why, Dan? Because I'm a professional.
Yeah. I'm just reeling from the news that this movie had subplots that were cut out and reshoots. I didn't show up. That was not like apparent at all.
It was crazy. Originally, Doolittle didn't even talk to animals. That was something they added. It was about a guy who thinks he can talk to animals, but he can't really. And the animals are like, why does this guy think he understands us? We're not saying
God,
that.
How long is this going to go on?
Hey, Rick, I think it's time for you to head out. I should probably start with a summary of the movie.
Okay, well, I've got some other funny stories. There was a time John Goodman stopped by, but we didn't recognize him because he had all this makeup on him, and we thought it was the guy from Parasite.
It's the same guy.
Really?
Yeah, it's the same guy.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, I'm just going to get going now. See you guys. La, da, 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 da.
He's slowly walking off the screen.
I just want to...
Still walking.
Okay.
And he's off.
I want to provide a little more background just to say that this is, I mean, like the Dr. Doolittle novels are by Hugh Lofting, and they began in, the first one was published in 1920. The final was published in 1952. There are 15 books. Some of the books were posthumous, collecting stories that he left behind.
You got to admire anybody's work ethic when they keep writing after they've died.
Yes.
It's like him and...
an Englishman, and it comes out through his stories. They have a certain I don't know. They've got the same vibe as like Mary Poppins, I think, in a certain way, like other English children's stories of the same basic period.
But there's a little bit of a Babar in it too, in the sense of it is the purpose of white Europeans to train all animals and people to be like them, which does not age well. Mm-hmm. In the books, I remember loving those books when I was a kid, but I wasn't really thinking about what rights does a giant talking snail have when Dr. Right. Doolittle shows up to meet him.
I believe there's a book where he goes to the moon. Am I right in thinking that?
Probably.
Dr. Doolittle in the Moon, and I'm reading, I just found this, first sentence of the plot summary. Dr. Doolittle has landed on the moon. So I don't
Chapter
know how
one,
got there,
page
but.
One.
I mean, it gets down to business. You can say that for it.
Well, the thing was, they had found a sort of alien monolith on the moon, and they needed Dr. Doolittle to come talk to it. And he's the only one who understood that language.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The great communicator.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so Dr. Doolittle is a movie. This is
that's a different movie. This is Doolittle.
That's true.
Dr. Doolittle has Eddie Murphy in it, right?
There's two previous Dr. Doolittle movies.
Or Rex Harrison, depending on...
The Rex Harrison movie from the late 60s, which they're in the great book Pictures at a Revolution and in the great book The Studio, they talk about, respectively, its Oscar campaign and the making of. I should have named the books in the reverse order. And it was one of these. It was kind of one of the last gasps of this studio system where they were like, "We're going to make real big budget, family friendly musicals, and then we're going to force the Oscars to nominate them." And then there was the Dr. Doolittle with Eddie Murphy, where it's pretty much just the name and the fact that he can talk to animals. I think that's because he's not in the books. He's not really a doctor, is he? I can't remember.
Well, he's a veterinarian.
Oh, so
like this movie,
but he's not like a people doctor.
Right, whereas I believe in the Eddie Murphy movie, as in this, he is in Eddie Murphy, he's like a surgeon. He's like a human surgeon who has long repressed his ability to speak to animals. Like, well, he's ignored it his whole life until now.
That's the other thing is in the Doolittle books and in this one, it's a skill you can learn. Anyone who pays close enough attention to animals learn to talk. But in Dr. Doolittle, it's like more of a Drop Dead Fred type ability.
Now, hold on. I'm going back to the first book just to get a little context. He is a respected physician and a quiet bachelor living with his spinster sister, Sarah, in the small English village of Puddleby on the Marsh.
Okay. See, I thought he was like a doctor of literature or something like that.
No, John Doolittle, M.D. here. So
wow,
I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of surprised they didn't name this movie John Doolittle, M.D. and make it like a gritty reboot of the Dr. Doolittle
house.
Story. Yeah, where he's like...
M.D. stands for Massive Ding Dong.
I mean, that would be kind of gritty, I guess.
I mean, if you say anything, it sounds pretty gritty in my gritty voice.
I'm a doctor of penis having. So so let's get into this. So this is the newest version of Doolittle, and they make a few strange decisions with the story.
Yes.
And the performers make some very strange decisions with their performances. And, well, let's get into it, because it's kind of all over the place. We begin, as most great movies do, with a prologue that explains who all the characters are and all their backstory, so that later when the other characters are piecing together the clues of why Dr. Doolittle has secluded himself from humanity, we, the audience, already know all of this, and it is boring. But, the best part of the movie. It's this animated prologue that looks beautiful, where they explain, it's narrated by Emma Thompson, who, of course, throughout the movie is a parrot, where it talks about how Dr. Doolittle, he was a famous doctor who could talk to animals, he had an explorer girlfriend named Lily, and she's kind of like a, I don't know, what would you call, like a Cutthroat Island Gina Davis type, you know? Based on the way she dresses, and like kind of a lady pirate buccaneer explorer, and they marry. Unfortunately, she dies at sea. Ooh, shades of Frozen there. And he becomes a recluse with his animals in a sort of Tim Burton-esque Wonder Emporium of a house that has some like steampunk conveyor belts and things like that. And it made me realize,
And it's like semi-rotoscoped, so it's kind of a good introduction for your kid before you show them a Scanner Darkly, for instance.
No, that
I was going to say. Good.
To the computerized rotoscoping and the presence of Robert Downey Jr. together make it impossible to not think of a Scanner Darkly.
It is. I was talking recently to my wife about Scanner Darkly and how Robert Downey Jr.'s performance in that is so good, and part of it is because he's so great, and it was at a time when he was coming back from rock bottom, and so he is not automatically the coolest, hippest dude in the world. He's not Iron Man in it. And I was like, oh, I forgot he can play characters other than Iron Man, and he's so good in it.
That whole phase of his career, sort of like starting with The Singing Detective and up to Iron Man, like when it was basically just, I don't know, it's like when some basketball player, like, you know, tears their Achilles and they're gone for a while and then they come back and you're like, oh, like, right, this guy is incredible. Like, he's just been untapped for like 10 years.
I would call it the... He was Iron Man. Yeah, I would call it the proving they should insure me for the production period of a career.
But like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Good Night Good Luck, you know, Scanner Darkly, Zodiac, right? Like that whole run pre-Iron Man is very exciting.
He's so good in Zodiac. And then he makes Iron Man, and he's great as Iron Man, but it's like it's now fantastic. Iron Man is to him kind of what Jack Sparrow is to Johnny Depp, where people are like, oh, we love this performance. Do just that from now on.
It's so funny that you bring up Jack Sparrow, because Robert Downey Jr.'s accent in this movie, Doolittle, makes me yearn for the careful enunciation of Captain Jack Sparrow. I mean,
is it? And this is one of the major performance problems. And we get to it when it's more important, I guess. But Robert Downey Jr. has made the decision to, one, put on kind of a strange Welshy type accent, and two, do every line in a hushed, whispery tone, even when he's irritated. So instead of being like, "Animals, leave me alone," he's like, "Animals, leave me alone." And it was like, why does it always sound like Shrek is whispering at me? I don't understand.
Shrek's ASMR tape.
So first, though, we meet Stubbins, a little boy who also loves animals, even though his dad just wants him to hunt all the time. Stubbins is what I ended up realizing is a totally unnecessary character, as we'll find out. He accidentally shoots a squirrel, and rather than put the CGI squirrel out of its misery like his heartless dad does, he instead follows Doolittle's parrot Polly, Emma Thompson, who appears out of nowhere as if like Mary Poppins or Nanny McPhee, a magical being, and leads him to Doolittle's estate, which is full of CGI animals. And Stubbins, I gotta tell you, doesn't seem particularly amazed to suddenly see elephants and giraffes wandering around an English estate. He takes it pretty much in stride. The way you would take, like, he reacted to it the way I would, like, you see a busker on the street in New York, where for an instant it distracts your attention, and then you're like, not interested in that, and you turn your head away. So, he gets caught.
He does shriek at the presence of a gorilla.
Yes.
Well, who wouldn't, Dan?
He has a high-pitched shriek.
And he gets caught in a net because there is a trap there, I guess, for, I don't know, poachers or somebody. Okay. Doolittle, now we finally get to really meet him. He is recluse bearded, and his animals help him get dressed in a kind of weird take on the scene was it Snow White or Cinderella where the animals help her dress, or both?
I think it's
possibly
Cinderella.
Sleeping Beauty, but also maybe all of those.
Look, Disney princesses cannot get dressed without the help of animals. We know that.
Yeah.
It was like a little bit of like Pee-wee's Big Adventure thrown in there.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It made me realize, so in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, I remember as a kid seeing that sequence where his breakfast gets made by his weirdo machines and thinking it was so amazing and so
Rube
funny.
Rube Goldberg is listening to our podcast and is so mad you just called them weirdo machines.
It's like, say my name, asshole. Say my name.
And I had one legacy.
This is the one thing I'm remembered for. Please, as a fellow Jew, remember me. And I'm like, hey, buddy, I'll put a stone in your grave, but like, leave me alone. So,
not my appearance in Artisan Models.
I don't think I've seen ever since then, like a kind of steampunky clockwork Rube Goldberg thing that has captured that level of magic. And why do you think that is? I was curious why you guys think that this, or unless this really hit you with a sense of wonder and possibility, this sequence.
Well, I mean, the Pee-wee thing is actually, like, you think of that as like, kind of a frantic movie in certain ways, but it takes it slow. You watch every individual thing happen, and you're amazed. Like there's a physicality to everything that happens. Like it feels like that is an actual machine rather than some CGI creation because they didn't use CGI. And also, like, it leads up to the joke where Pee-wee eats an incredibly small amount of breakfast before being
and then wipes
full.
His mouth with the napkin very daintily. When I was a kid, my sister and I, that's all we would do after we ate was we would just take napkins and lightly dab the corners of our mouths like he does, and we'd leave all this food on our face.
It reflects his personality, right? It's like silly and overly busy, and like, you know, like he's very invested in it, and it's funny. Whereas, like, I feel like Doolittle is he's so laconic and uninterested in his magical house full of magical animals. Like, It seems like these things are happening to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we talked about his dead wife before, but I do think that I want to take a moment and talk about how, like, so this is why he's withdrawn from the world, and I do not understand this need for movies to give these kind of magical characters tragic backstories. Like, if you think about, say, Willy Wonka, right? Like, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Like, Willy Wonka doesn't have the arc there. Like, Charlie has what the closest thing to an arc in that movie. Willy Wonka is just this magical pixie who is himself and doesn't need to have a reason to be that way. And like, I feel like Doolittle, like, it should be the same thing. Like, Dr. Doolittle is Dr. Doolittle. No need to be like, oh, he has a dead wife, and that's motivating the action of this movie to some degree.
Well, Dan, I was reading Variety the other day, and there was this article saying how studios have all these fridges lying around, and you just got to throw these wives in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're losing money on those fridges if they don't put wives, girlfriends, and assorted parents in there.
And also, remember, Tim Burton perverted that by giving Willy Wonka a tragic backstory, which was sort of an odd decision in its
own
right.
I mean, it wasn't that tragic. It was just that his dad didn't let him eat candy, right?
Yeah, right. Yes, exactly.
But it was the, like, look, I'm a weird defender of that movie. I think it's a bad choice
that
Johnny
Depp
is making. But otherwise, it's a pretty good adaptation of the book, except for they shove in this dentist shit in the middle of it.
Why do you think it's a bad choice for Johnny Depp to make?
I think it's a little too creepy. Like, I think that Willy Wonka should be this character who makes candy, but his relationship to kids is hard to pin down. You know, but like,
I mean, I feel like that's what you got in that movie. I think I admire that in a world where Gene Wilder's Willy Wonka already exists, there's no reason to do that Willy Wonka again because it's perfect. But the that, like, he was
there's a lot of shit in that movie that's not Gene Wilder. That's not very good.
No, but I'm just talking about Gene Wilder's performance.
Okay.
Just Gene Wilder's performance is perfect in that. And I think it's a valid choice for Johnny Depp to be like, who's a recluse who lives in an amusement park and wants kids around? Michael Jackson. I'll make the character like Michael Jackson. And I think it's a valid choice for that character, even if it doesn't totally work ultimately as an entertaining thing to watch.
Yes.
I think the dead wife, I mean, everything about this movie is a little shrouded in mystery because it was reshot, and I'm sure we'll all talk about, you know, but Steven Gagan, I think, you know, who is a bizarre choice to make a Dr. Doolittle movie, he's probably the one who's coming in and is like, this should have pathos, this should be about trauma and working things out, he should be more of a brain doctor than a body doctor, like, that everything seems to stem from that, all these weird, dark decisions.
I think that's probably part of it. Well, there's only three types of ways to adapt old stories now. You can either do a prequel that explains how he became Dr. Doolittle, and it's all about him learning how to talk to animals. You do a gritty reboot, like we talked about, John Doolittle, MD, where he's talking about what a massive ding-dong he's got, and as someone's killing the animals of London, and he has to, like, find the Jack the Ripper of animals. Or you do it like this, where it's like, remember the Doolittle stories from before, and he lived happily ever after? Well, whoever told you that must have lied, because Doolittle's got some sad stuff, too. But now he's going to come back, where it's the kid
life
rediscovered.
Life doesn't work that way, baby.
Where it's like the return to Oz of Doolittle's. Like, that's the only other way to do it. And they chose the one they wanted, and of those three, that's the one it works the most for me, I guess.
Elliot, there's not the only way. You could do it the way that I think they're...
Oh, no,
I think
Sam, you can do it. I'm just saying now, those are the three studio-approved ways to adapt a story. Prequel,
do it.
Dark reboot, or it's 20 years later and somebody's got to shake them out of their doldrums.
Well, I guess this isn't an American movie, but you can do it the Paddington way, which I think at this film's best moments is what it's trying to shoot for, honestly, and not really doing it, but like just fucking accept the book for what it is, accept the vibe of it, like not... You know, explain why there's this bear from Darkest Peru who likes marmalade and wants to go to London too much. Just have that be who that is and have Dr. Doolittle be a guy who loves animals and goes on adventures.
Because I haven't seen the Paddington movies, but here's the way I would have done it. So you start in Peru, and it starts with Paddington's grandfather.
I mean, you should really watch the Paddington movies.
You would enjoy the Paddington.
Yeah,
I will.
Great.
You're right. I've got lots of time on my hands, and I'll watch. Actually, every time I suggest watching them to Sammy, he thinks they're going to be scary, so he doesn't want to watch them.
I will say, honestly, for me, the first one is good, but I kind of got bored. The second one is amazing.
So here's how I would do it. Darkest Peru, it's 30 years ago. An old bear shows up and tells a young bear, there's a prophecy.
Okay.
Your grandson will be the chosen bear. Okay. And his name shall be Pa Ding Tun. And so then you cut flash forward to I'm walking on sunshine, and Paddington is just kind of like in Peru, love and life, just being like, hey, buddy, hey, look over there. And you just hear the voiceover. Now it's just Sonic at this point, where he's like, hey, I'm having a great, cool life, but uh-oh, what's happening now? Let me rewind a little bit. And you see how his family, like, so the movie would end with him getting to London, because that sets up the PCU, the Paddington Cinematic Universe. And the next one is the Rise of Paddington, and that's how he like meets the family. And the last
starring Jeremy Piven.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. And the last one is called Aftermath, Paddington Aftermath, or like or Dawn of the Rise of Paddington. And that's the one where he loses the family, but he becomes the hero that they all need him to be. So that's Paddington.
Now, wait, hold on. I have a very important question for David.
Yes.
What is it like being on this podcast and sort of like having to endure a griffin, let's say, but like one that you don't have years of friendship and history with?
No, you're thinking about this all wrong. I'm just like, oh, someone else can handle anything else. I'm just here to like float and have fun and occasionally interject with silliness.
You don't have to drive the car. It's probably
exactly
great.
I don't have to try and keep trains on time like I do on my show. I'm just here listening, laughing. It's great.
I mean, it's the thing that my friend said to me once. I was like, would you babysit for us? She's like, yeah, I love babysitting. Because the kids start crying, I know I'm going home at the end of the night. It's like, oh, yeah, that's... So
yeah, that's basically my approach to bartending, by the way.
Doolittle is playing chess with his gorilla, who is voiced by Rami Malek.
Yes.
In one of several
Oscar-worthy performance,
and who has the great catchphrase, "I am not a prisoner of fear."
Yeah, there for some reason, Rami Malek misunderstands what he's being told and shows his butt to Dr. Doolittle while they're playing chess. But ironically, a man who won an Oscar for lip syncing is now doing just the voice while a gorilla lip syncs. Amazing, but there are a lot of really good, talented actors in this that are for some reason chosen to do the voices for cartoon animals and have been directed to deliver the lines as if they are people who are standing in a booth trying to get their lines done in time to get out so they don't have to be paid overtime. And it's one of these movies where it really hit me how much they needed like cartoon voice actors to do the voices for these animals. Like, as much as I want, who was it who does the voice of the duck?
Octavia Spencer.
As much as I want Octavia Spencer to get a paycheck because she's great.
Yeah.
She's not my go-to person for the voice of a funny duck character. But anyway,
yeah. They had Ralph Ineson playing the human father of the kid. Like, that's money on the table, dude. He's got a great voice. That's like a perfect, like, you cast John Cena to do the voice of a bear. He's completely hairless. He's not a bear.
Get a hairy guy to do it. Get the late Robin Williams to do it. A man covered in hair. The other thing which we soon learn is that this movie takes place during the reign of Queen Victoria, and the humans all speak in a sort of, you know, antique Victorian way, but all the animals speak in normal modern slang, to the point where an octopus later tells Dr. Doolittle, snitches get stitches, and the polar bear is like, hey, bro, yeah, you did it, awesome. And it's like, when I recently watched Paris is Burning for the first time, and I was like, oh, all of our slang comes from drag culture of the 1980s. I didn't realize all of our slang even further comes from animal culture of the 1880s. Uh-huh. Guys,
yeah, I mean,
we've been stealing from the animals.
I gotta say, like, I don't understand the problem, Elliot. I don't know why you would expect animals, you know, dialects to have evolved in the same way that humans talk.
That's a good point.
Like, they have this whole separate idiom, you know?
Yeah, that involves, like, what almost, like, I would kept waiting for a pop culture reference to now, and it never quite got that far, but they got pretty close, I think.
Yeah.
Guys, I have a serious question. Now, I may have missed this, but they explain that the humans can, like, if they spend enough time around these animals and they study hard, they can learn how to speak animal language.
Yes.
Do they explain how all the animals can talk with each other?
Well, they all speak Galactic Basic.
But they specify that different animals speak different languages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
But at the same time, it's like he only has to pick up one thing, which doesn't make any sense. Okay. But you know what I mean? Like when the when the kid is describing how he's learning all of the little idiosyncrasies. I mean, I prefer the Eddie Murphy, look, he's touched by an angel. Like, that's better. Like, just
I mean,
the best
version of it is when we years ago we did Zookeeper with the King of Queens.
Of course.
And he gets hit on the head, and I was like, oh, he's going to get hit on the head, and it's going to give him the ability to talk to animals. And the animals were like, no, we can always talk. We just don't like doing it around people. And I was like, well, why don't you talk to people and tell them not to eat you and kill you?
Like, so they just hit him on the head just to hit him on the head?
No, no, yeah. he has an accident and gets hit on the head, and then the animals are like crowded around him. And I think it's the lion voiced by, I believe, Sly Stallone, who says, yeah, we just don't talk around people because it freaks them out. And it's like, but you've been imprisoned. You know,
yeah,
why
the thing is, like,
tell them you shouldn't be there.
The reason it freaks them out is you haven't been doing it. Like, if you did it all the time, like, it would just be part of the fabric of life.
Yeah, but they know it would just destabilize society too much at this point. It's just awkward at this point.
I mean, the society that treats their lives as playthings and food. They have nothing to lose from this, except their chains. So Stubbins, the boy we mentioned before, he meets Lady Rose, an emissary from the Queen, the character who I believe should be in the Stubbins role, because Stubbins is going to go on a quest with Dr. Doolittle and become his apprentice. And this Lady Rose character basically just shows up to say the Queen's in trouble and then doesn't get to go on the adventure. And how much better would this movie have been if it was like a man and like a sassy little girl, or at least a brave little girl, rather than a man and like Stubbins, who, all due respect to the kid playing him, has no personality whatsoever. You know, they also meet the scaredy cat gorilla whose name is Chi-Chi. I assume after the restaurant chain of the same name. Or maybe he grew up to found that chain? I don't know.
Uh-huh, yep.
Anyway, let's get to the plot, shall we? The Queen is sick. Doolittle's like, I don't care. But after saving Stubbins' squirrel from an operation, the squirrel vows revenge on Stubbins, which never pays off in any way whatsoever.
I gotta say, though, the squirrel is Craig Robinson. Like, I laughed at a few of his lines. Like,
yeah, he's
later
funny.
On, he's... Yeah, later on, he's like day 24. I don't know why I'm still following these lunatics.
Right. The thing is, everyone is giving the vocal performance of, okay, I'll do a weekend in a booth for you, Robert. Like, sure, you'll owe me a favor. But if you have a comedian like Kumail Nanjiani, Craig Robinson, at least they'll be funny. It's the it's the people like John Cena or Rami Malek where you're like, what is it you're looking for? Like, you're not going to get pathos from Rami Malek. Like, I don't know.
Well, it's the same problem that the movie Ferdinand had. I know all you guys also took your sons to see Ferdinand during the coldest winter in New York history. In the last 100 years, I took my son to see Ferdinand and I was like, this is not a bad movie, but the voices are so flat. I mean, part of it is that they had, what's that football player's name who's in it?
Peyton Manning, I believe.
Peyton Manning. I mean, don't cast Peyton Manning as a voice in your funny animal movie. But like the voices, the delivery was so flat that even like, I'm forgetting every single name in the world from Saturday Night Live and Ghostbusters and
Kate McKinnon,
like even her, like the reads were kind of off, and it was like, I don't know what's going on with voice directing these days.
Well, but also, I mean, the problem is, as Billy West would rail against if he were here, like they're employing, you know, celebrities to do voices when that's not necessarily their strong point. Like there are actors who do this all the time and are very good at it, you know.
They have nice faces that I like to look at. That's sort of the whole deal of being a famous actor.
Well, that's the funny, I thought it's such a funny thing that when an animated movie goes overseas, the actors from the American dub do press overseas. So like when Madagascar was in other countries, like Ben Stiller and everybody would go do press there, even though their voices were not even in the movie. Yeah. So it's like, because they dub it with a local language actor. So it was like, hey, so here's this movie. I'm in it, except I'm not really in it because you're not going to see me or hear me, but I'm famous. So ask me some questions about it.
Griffin, I'm sorry, but I haven't. Griffin told a story about Jesse Eisenberg, I think, getting like a call from his agent being told, like, hey, Rio is like the biggest movie in Brazil. Like, it's huge. Rio. And Jesse Eisenberg had to be like, I had nothing to do. I'm not involved in the Brazilian version of Rio. You don't need to call me.
I mean, also for a movie called Rio to be a big hit in Brazil is like, I mean, come on. If it's not, you screwed something up. Come on.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's like a sound design thing, or maybe it's just the voice acting or direction, but like I had a lot of trouble telling where any voice was coming from. Like, it all was just this mishmash where I could never tell if, like, a character was on the other side of the room.
Well, I don't know whether this is related or not, but, like, the famous story about this is that, like, Stephen Kagan is the original director of this before there were reshoots, did not have it planned out where the animals would be on screen, which is crazy, a crazy way to do a movie with CGI animals. And so a lot of it is ADR'd, like, a lot of it is, like, jerry-rigged after the fact.
Yeah, Kagan was just like, we'll figure it out. Like, he did not get, I think, that you need to plan, pre-vis all this crap in advance.
Because there's a fair amount of, like, ostriches running by in the background with their heads off camera while they say a line, and it's like, yeah, okay, I guess they just stuck that in because they had a line from the ostrich and he wasn't in the scene at the moment, so they had to have him run by in the background and say it. But they're going to go, they have to go save the queen, because here's the thing. The queen gave Dr. Doolittle the lease for this house, but if she dies, he's going to lose the house, and the animals are going to have to go to the zoo. And the animals shave him so they can go. We're introduced to the other animals. They're Dab Dab the duck, Octavia Spencer. There's Plimpton the ostrich, who's Kumail Nanjiani, Channing Tatum as the polar bear whose name I forgot, and Stubbins kind of stows away in their trunk. Meanwhile, back at Buckingham Palace, the evil Dr. Mudfly, played by Michael Sheen, is leeching the queen to ensure that she dies. Uh-oh, there's some nefarious doings about. But luckily, Gyps the dog smells something suspicious, and then the queen's octopus, after telling Doolittle snitches get stitches, tells them it's poison. It turns out the only cure is the fruit from the Eden tree, the very tree of legend that Doolittle's wife was looking for when she died in a storm. Bump,
right.
bum.
And like, Doolittle explains it, he's like, oh, it's like from a tree no one has seen on an island no one knows exists. And like he does like this whole thing, and I'm like, well, then how do you know about this island? Like, if...
Is this supposed to be like the tree of life? Like, is that the idea?
I have to assume so.
Yeah.
Okay.
I feel like that must have been an idea. That must have been an idea in the movie at some point. That was either elided or changed. But also, they say like it can cure anything and gives eternal life. But that's not what the fruit from the tree in Eden did. Like the tree in Eden, the fruit gave you the knowledge of good and evil.
Yeah.
Which is the queen, I assume, already knows good and evil, or she shouldn't be in charge of a country.
So you're saying nude is evil, Elliot?
So I have to say, I was expecting Doolittle to have to go get in a riddle contest with Wotan in order to get this fruit, but I guess I was disappointed. There's no mythological happenings at all in the rest of this movie, right?
No, well, we'll see. Perhaps there's a mythological animal later on. Stubbins, he sneaks along as a Doolittle's apprentice on this journey. There's a brief giraffe chase where a French dog, right, or fox or something, is riding a giraffe. And it's,
yes, that is Marion Cotillard.
It's one of those things where at the end of the credits, like, Marion Cotillard. And I was like, not only do I not know why Marion Cotillard was chosen, I don't know why that character was in the movie. Because all she does is... She just has that one scene with the giraffe, right? Where I assume she's the giraffe's, like, lover, and that's why she's riding on the back with Stubbins. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
And the giraffe was Selena Gomez, right?
Yes, the giraffe is Selena Gomez. I just have to imagine there's a whole, like, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern plot with them that they had to cut. Why else would you bring in Academy Award winner Marion Cotillard? There's a French fox named Tutu.
For all those kids who loved Lovey and Rose and want to see her in more of their movies.
Yeah, of course.
It involves them jumping onto Doolittle's boat from a bridge. It's all very unnecessary. And Polly, the parrot, Emma Thompson, tells Doolittle, you need a human around you to remind you that you're human. Meanwhile, this evil aristocrat, played by Jim Broadbent, wants to kill the queen and take the throne. I don't know if he really understands how monarchy works. If the queen dies, it's not going to be this random Chamberlain dude who becomes the king. Like, that
seems
like pretty basic.
Kind of a military coup is what he's planning? I'm not really sure.
Well, I mean, to weigh in with my knowledge of British history, if this Victoria...
Wait, David, did you live in England, or is that...
I did live in England.
Oh, you lived in England.
So
you grew up
life.
In England. Yes. Interesting. Oh.
Yes, and that's something that's normal and well-known about me, and it's regular news. If Queen Victoria, I mean, how old is she supposed to be, right? She's in her 30s. This is young Victoria.
Yeah.
You know, so her kid would be like 10 years old, if not, you know, so maybe he's looking for a regency, you know, he wants to like sit on the throne while there's a child king.
Maybe, but it's like, I don't know if Victoria had any siblings, but usually the younger sibling would then... Because I don't know that she had any children.
No,
at that point.
It goes kids first, then siblings.
I don't know that she's
expert in royal primogeniture.
But I don't know that she had any kids at that point. Okay, Stu, I'm going to need you to use your famous research skills to look up how old Queen Victoria was during the events of this movie, which is based on true fact. I mean, it was just so strange to me to see Queen Victoria presented as a young woman. When, in my mind, she's a stout, dowdy old lady who says, "We are not amused," to Sherlock Holmes.
So yeah. I plugged that into the search bar in the Metal Archives. No results. Okay.
Disappointing. Especially since Britain has such a strong presence on the metal scene.
Yeah,
but,
you think. And Jim Broadbent, you know, I've seen him play bigger, crazier characters, but, you know, it's fun to see him. And he's got Michael Sheen delivering his best, like, John Hodgman style character as an evil doctor general, right?
Yeah, yeah. Michael Sheen, Dr. Mudfly, is obsessed with how Dr. Doolittle always got everything he wanted, and everyone thinks he's so great, but he's so crazy, and Dr. Mudfly's going to get it. And Dr. Mudfly seems to keep forgetting that Dr. Doolittle lost his wife to a shipwreck and has lived as a recluse for years. So he's like, at the end of the movie, he's like, "Dr. Doolittle, now you're going to see what it's like to not get what you want for a change." And it's like, he's a widower. Come on, man.
He's a widower, and also, you are doctor to the queen. Like, have you not ascended to your highest honors? Like, yeah. You're like, what more could you be?
Maybe that he just said, always wanted a pet gorilla. I don't know.
Yeah.
That said, Michael Sheen is one of the best things about this movie. I feel like even
inarguably
reviews
the
at the time.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's Michael Sheen is acting in the movie that this wants to be. Because look, guys, yes. I'll put some of my cards on the table. I did not find this to be as disastrous a movie as I had been led to believe, partly because it looks beautiful. It's bright and colorful. It's not grim and gray and beige and brown everywhere and like black and white and with no colors. But it's like it wants to be this like cartoony – or it should be this cartoony romp like you're saying, Dan. But instead it's like it's weighted down by all these elements that don't really fit into that. So by the time they are like literally running from Barbary Coast pirates – it's like, why is this boring? Like, I don't understand why they're on a pirate island fighting a tiger, and it's boring for some reason.
I will say, I watched this film again. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for putting the work in. I appreciate it. Dan doesn't always do that.
Right. I rented it on iTunes, and I just got an alert from iTunes that my rental period's almost up. So, you know, obviously, I got to keep an eye on that. But, and on my TV, I did not think – I think this is a quite bad movie, but it's pretty easy to ignore. Like, you can just kind of, like, have it on and, like, oh, what's – okay, antics. Okay, yeah, the animals are making jokes. Seeing this in a theater, it really felt like being imprisoned with it. Like, and really – it really – like, when you're really locked in with it, really highlights how bizarre some of the editing and some of the sort of story smoothing is. Like – it will jump from scene to scene with the parrot trying to like fill in narrative gaps really quickly in this way where you're just like, is an act missing? Like, what happened?
Oh, that's right. I forgot that, like, to mention, this comes up especially with the pirate island where they're like, we're going to have to sneak into that pirate island. And Polly is like, so they did sneak into the pirate island. And then this is what happened. And it's like, was there going to be a scene where they snuck into the pirate island?
Like, it feels like there's whole reels that they were just like, I don't know. They must have fallen off the truck. Who cares?
See,
just put it out.
That's very interesting to hear that it was a different experience because, to your point, like when we were watching it, Audrey was like, "See, this would be a perfectly fine thing to take a nap to on a Sunday."
Like, yeah, I was like, "Oh man, this is going to be disastrous." And then I was like, I briefly considered watching it with my son, and I was like, I don't want to subject him to it. But now I'm like, he could have watched it, and it would have been fine, and you know, he would have. I'm sure he would have enjoyed parts of it. Like this is,
He might have been. There is that like kind of erotic scene where Antonio Banderas is just languishing amidst beautiful tigers. Like, I don't know, it's pretty erotic.
Post tiger orgy scene where you know they fucked a bunch of tigers.
I don't know if you want to introduce children to that. No, it's a little intense.
I mean, the real problem is my son during the giraffe chase would be like, "What voice is that? Where have I heard that voice? Is that Marion Cotillard? Wait a minute. Hold on. No, it can't be." And he
of
it would
two
it would
days,
really
one night?
the same way that we watched Big Hero 6 yesterday, and I hadn't seen it, and I was like, who is that voice? And it bugged me the whole movie. I'm like, oh, James Cromwell. That's who that voice is.
That's right.
And then I said to him, oh, that's the farmer from Babe. And he was like, whatever.
whatever, Dad.
Anyway, they're on. So Jim Broadbent sends Mudfly to go after Doolittle to stop him from saving the queen at all costs. Doolittle is on the ship. He's boxing the gorilla, trying to teach it to be brave, because, you know, it's a gorilla who's afraid of things. It's hilarious. Then he hears an eerie whistle at night and remembers his wife. This, I don't quite know what they were getting at for sure here, but it happens. And there, and that's when I realized one of the monkeys on the ship is named Elliot. So I was like, that's cool. Doolittle calls a whale to help them with a warship that Dr. Mudfly is commanding, and they tie a harness to the whale to move their ship faster, and the warship fires, and Chi-Chi, the gorilla, gets scared and drops Doolittle's scuba rope because he's in kind of like a steampunk scuba suit, or, you know, one of those Aqualung-type bathysphere suits. But he survives just fine, thanks to Stubbins, and they escape. And that's when we really learn that Mudfly is obsessed with Dr. Doolittle, and Mudfly establishes himself as the funniest character in the movie. But there's a lot of, like, a lot of Mudfly just going like, oh, Doolittle, And I wasn't sure if I liked how single-minded he is, or if there were times where I was like, I want to see a little more about what Mudfly does when he's not fuming about
Doolittle.
I mean,
there was Doolittle. That good gag where he was, like, looking through his telescope, and Doolittle had said something about, like, how he was chinless or something. And like, way up,
about my
way
chin.
Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah, that was funny.
I think that there's a sort of a meta funniness to it as well, because it's fair for the other characters to be like, why is there a fuss about this Doolittle guy? Downey is barely trying. Like, you know, like, the performance is so baffling that it, like, I can under, like, Sheen should probably just be Dr. Doolittle. He'd be a good Dr. Doolittle.
He would have been a great Dr. Doolittle. Yeah. Like, he would have been a fantastic Dr. Doolittle. The fact that Robert Downey Jr.'s performance, it's not just, like, Doolittle's not just a reluctant hero. He's a reluctant living being. Like,
yeah.
You expect, well, like, also, I don't know why this guy didn't do still, like, just stop breathing and see if, and pass out over and over again just to get away from day-to-day life. Like, he seems to hate just existing.
That's where the depth comparison makes sense, too, where it's like, I feel like both these stars became kind of almost hostile to their own charisma. They just got sick of their usual thing and were like, well, how about I just tie all my limbs behind my back and see if, you know, the movie's still a hit? Like, anti-fun can I be?
Well, there must be something. It's similar to, when somebody is so, it becomes so effortless to be successful that you try to sabotage yourself to see what it is, or you're so worried.
I know all about that, Elliot.
Like, I'm sure the studio is like, just do Iron Man, that'll be great, just be Tony Stark, and like, for whatever reason, obviously he did not want to do that.
I mean, because he had just been Tony Stark in like 9 movies over 2 decades, so he's like,
and all that made
him
was $1 billion.
The other thing about his performance, though, is like, just get a fucking English guy. Like, Robert Downey Jr. is great, but him trying to do a Welsh accent, like this is a little better than his terrible English accent in the Sherlock Holmes movies, but he's not a character guy in that way, I don't think. So why put that on him?
And like, I think Michael Sheen, is he Welsh? Yeah, he is. So like,
yes,
you got a Welsh guy who'd be really great at it right there.
Yeah.
But Michael Sheen doesn't open big blockbusters, Dan, because without a big star, what do you have to convince kids to go see a movie about a doctor who talks to animals and goes on an amazing adventure with pirates? What possible reason would a kid want to see that for, unless it has a big boffo box office name in it, like Channing Tatum?
Like, are kids like, Downey Jr.'s in it? Okay, but who voices the polar bear? Like, John Cena! All right, let's go! Friday
like,
night!
They're like, is anyone from The Big Sick in it?
Yeah, they're like, I'm real into alt comedy. Is Jason Mantzoukas in this movie?
Was Jason Mantzoukas clearly added very late in the game?
Yeah. That feels like that. I was just glancing through the trivia. Didn't like Seth Rogen or somebody take a stab at a couple rewrites? And I feel like Jason Mantzoukas's part either got completely added or totally bulked out because I mean, it's funny, but it doesn't add anything to the story of the movie.
I mean, right. he does wake up a tiger at one point.
Oh, that's true.
Now, speaking of, it's time for the side quest that involves Jason Mantzoukas, because they can't just go straight to the Eden Tree. It's on an island that never exists, that nobody has ever heard of, because it's not real or whatever. They've got to go to Pirate Island to steal Lily's journal, because that's the only place that says where the island is. This island, it's called, Monteverde, I think it's called, and it's run by King Antonio Banderas, whose character's name I don't remember, but he is Lily's father, and so he's especially mad at Doolittle, because he blames him for not being there when Lily died, as if Doolittle would have been able to save her from the shipwreck. It's a little unclear why he thinks Doolittle should have been there at the time. I don't know. But he blames
him. Kids can tell that Antonio Banderas' character is going to be an evil king because he already has multiple statues celebrating himself before he's dead, and that's never a good sign, and kids are aware of that.
Yeah, kids remember their Roman history, and they were like, shades of Caligula, perhaps, as they nudge each other.
And then the tiger orgy happens, and they all get it.
Yeah, and then they're like, oh, this guy's super cool. So they team up. Stubbin sneaks in with the help of some mafia ants and a heart-sick dragonfly. but accidentally, they wake up the king and his lions. Oh, they're lions, not tigers. I'm sorry. It's a tiger later. And he wakes up, and he locks them all in a dungeon. He lets Stubbins go, but he wants Doolittle to be eaten by a tiger named Barry. Meanwhile, Doolittle is being taunted by a criminal rabbit who is also in jail with an eye patch. And it's one of those things where it's like, wait, so is this rabbit like a rabbit that talks and is a criminal and commits crimes? Because the other animals don't have, like, the other animals, the idea of locking them up in a jail cell seems crazy.
Yeah. What was his beef with Doolittle? He seemed to have a personal dislike.
Which, the rabbit or the tiger?
The rabbit. Well,
the rabbit,
either one of them. I wasn't really clear.
Well, the tiger is a former patient of Doolittle's, and for some reason Doolittle abandoned him his feelings of never living up to his mother's expectations for him. That's the tiger. The rabbit just seems to be a jerk, and the rabbit has the line that made me glad my son didn't see the movie, because it would have become his favorite line, where the tiger walks in and the rabbit goes, oh, did Doolittle do a little doo-doo? I think you did do a little doo-doo. And I was like, oh, boy, okay.
I was actively appreciating the fact that this movie didn't seem to have any toilet humor for a long time, and then it all came at once.
it's backloaded.
Yeah, rushing out to you like a blocked-up dragon suddenly releasing a huge gas fart right in your face. There is also, this is the part where he's being attacked by this tiger. He tries a couple different funny ways to stop him, but he can't. Chi-Chi the gorilla finally overcomes his fear and kicks Barry in what Barry refers to as his Barry Berries. And it's almost like at this point with Doo-Doo and Barry Berries, Dan, the movie just kind of like is like, you know what? We're just doing the toilet humor. It's like the story Albert Brooks tells about opening for a band and not getting any laughs, and he goes, so I did it. I said shit. And then the audience goes crazy because he starts swearing on stage, and they love it. So they steal Lily's journal, but Mudfly takes it, and he's like, yeah, I'm a bad guy. I'm going to kill Queen Victoria. See ya. And they sink Doolittle's boat, and the polar bear saves the ostrich, thus cementing their friendship. A subplot that was not really set up too far ahead of time, but it was set up a little bit, that they were kind of prickly with each other, but now they're best buds.
Yes? why is Michael Sheen going to get the magical thing that can cure the queen if he's just trying to kill the queen?
To stop Robert Downey Jr. from getting it. And maybe he's also going to be like, look, I made this discovery. I'm famous now. Alas, too late to save our beloved queen.
Well, but also, they try and explain it. They say that this island has all these, like unknown flora and fauna that, like, because he's a scientist too, he will get all the glory of studying it, I guess.
I wish they had gone even farther and made Charles Darwin the villain of the movie. And Martin Sheen was playing Charles Darwin, and it was like, no, if animals can talk to humans, it throws my whole theory of evolution and natural selection out the window. I have to defeat Dr. Doolittle. Like, that would be very funny to me. And so he has to go, and he's going to make this big scoop. It's going to be a second Galapagos, this magic island. Oh, I'll call it On the Origin of the Species 2, The Reorigining. Okay, guys, I think we have Dr. Doolittle 2 already ready in the can. So Dr. Doolittle's ready to give up, but the Pirate King, he says, hey, look, we both miss my daughter, so you need to keep going, and he gives them a ratty old pirate ship. They use whales to track Dr. Mudfly to Eden Island, and they finally get there, and the soldiers that are with Mudfly capture them, and Mudfly's like, hey, 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 I finally beat you. I guess not everything comes easy to Dr. Doolittle. Again, as I mentioned earlier, forgetting that Dr. Doolittle is a depressed widower and has lost the single most important thing to him
basically
in the universe.
Has no will to do anything whatsoever.
Who would have been a hermit if not for their plot to kill the queen.
Yeah, he's just scraping by at this point. He almost got eaten by a tiger.
I imagine somebody being like hating Franklin Delano Roosevelt and being like, see what it's like to not be the golden boy who gets everything. And Roosevelt being like, I can't walk. Like, look at me, dude. Like, I'm in a wheelchair. Did you forget about that? But then, there's a guardian for the Eden tree. It's a dragon. That's right, everybody. Someone mentioned dragons offhandedly once earlier in the movie. That was all the foreshadowing we needed. Dragons. The dragon scares the soldier away, and Doolittle instantly picks up dragon language because he's just that good. They bond over having both lost their spouses, because in this world, even mythological creatures have a certain amount of trauma and survivor's guilt.
Yes, this was exactly the end of Batman v Superman, basically, where they're both like, your mom was Martha? My mom was Martha. Like we're both widows or widowers?
He manages...
And the dragon eats one of the British soldiers, which I think is kind of a stirring commentary on anti-colonialism.
And apparently has a lot of the Spanish army digested in her belly. There's all these axes and helmets getting pulled out of her.
The dragon, has devoured a lot of Spanish and now at least one British soldier. And dragons, we learn, like snakes, just swallow up in the whole thing whole and digest what they can from it. Because, guys, it's time for the apex of the fart humor. This dragon has a blockage in its rectum, and Dr. Doolittle, using only a leak because he's Welsh, will have to release it. And so he manages to remove all this armor, thus freeing an enormous fart that hits him square in the face, and every character seems to get their line where they talk about how smelly it is. And it was like, I get it. Just pick one. Just have one character comment.
I will make a not full-throated defense of this fart joke, because I hate fart
jokes.
Well, I don't hate fart jokes. I don't think they're necessary in a movie like this.
Dan, do you think your throat should be the orifice you're using to defend this, or the passage in your body to defend this fart
Let
joke?
Let me position my butt to the microphone. No, I... The one thing I like about this fart
Dan's
joke...
Dan's butt sounds just like his regular voice.
Yeah. The one thing I liked about this fart joke is how matter-of-fact everyone was after the fart joke. They were like... They were all like, oh, you know, it happens to everyone. Nothing to be ashamed of. Like, everyone was like trying to make the dragon feel better about the giant fart. I'm like, oh, that's kind of sweet. So there's a little everybody poops sort of reaction to this.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real strong tolerance and anti-bigotry message that we all fart. So are we really that different after all?
Even murderous dragons who devour humans whole.
Protecting some kind of quasi-mystical thing fruit, because then she says, hey, you have proven to me by helping me, both psychologically and anally, that you deserve this Eden fruit. And so they have the Eden fruit. They finally get there to Buckingham Palace just in time. The queen is just on her deathbed. Her life meter above her head is just blinking that last bar as it disappears.
Yeah. Right. The sonic music is playing. That's where she's at.
Yeah.
And Jim Broadbent has literally declared her dead at this point, too.
Yeah. I mean, he jumped the gun a little bit on that one, but he had his reasons. The bad guy, Jim Broadbent, he tries to have them arrested, but the animals clear a path for Stubbins, who manages to, like, slide through someone's legs and catch the Eden fruit and squeeze a drop to her lips. I would have just smashed the whole thing into her mouth. But
you he decides
to hope that this one drop makes it to her lips, but it does. She revives, and a stick insect, who Dr. Doolittle left on a painting there days before, rats out the Chamberlain. And the Chamberlain does the classic bad guy thing of, once he realizes they've got him dead to rights, instead of continuing to deny it, he pulls out a knife and tries to fight his way out, which is the guiltiest thing you can do. Yeah. He is caught by the... Because instead of being like, well, I'm the Chamberlain of London, and that's a stick insect that you say is talking, none of us can hear it. Like, I don't know if it's going to hold up in a court of law, you interpreting for a stick insect.
And and how can you trust this stick insect? All it did was sit around on a painting all day? Like, what a boring same thing. Like,
I wish it went to trial and he was like, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, can we trust an insect that's already trying to deceive us into thinking it's a stick? I rest my case. Your witness. And
if Brodman had kept his cool, he might have gotten away with it. Yeah,
the prosecutor for the state is like, he just eviscerated our case. We've got nothing now.
Shit, our lead witness is a bug? Who came up with this?
Okay, let me bring in the next witness. He got stepped on. What?
Yeah. At worst, they would cut a deal with the prosecutor in this situation.
But the idea that everyone's like, yeah, Doolittle says this bug said that thing. I guess he got him. Doolittle takes on Stubbins as an apprentice, and he reopens his home as a pet hospital and also leaves the movie open for a sequel. During the credits, we see paintings that seem to depict Doolittle and some of the animals being knighted by the queen. Yep. So there's a Sir Doolittle and a Lady Dab-Dab, I guess. And yeah. There's a mid-credit scene that did not go the way I thought it was, where Dr. Mudfly is still alive in the cave. And it seems like he's picked up the language of the bats in the cave. And it was like, oh, so he's going to come back in the sequel as a bad guy who talks to mean, like, evil, sinister animals. But then the bats, it's implied, I guess, eat him.
They turn him into Morbius the Living Vampire.
I guess so. They swarm all over him and he's gone.
It's a terrifying image. They like cover him. The swarm of bats in this children's film. Yeah, presumably they eat him to the bone.
And that's the end of it. And I guess we'll never find out what happened to Dr. Mudfly because I don't think there's going to be a Doolittle 2 or Doolittle, I guess is what they would call it.
Yeah.
I think this movie lost about $100 million. I don't think anyone's getting any sequels.
I expected a mid-credit sequence where we find that his wife is still alive, just shipwrecked somewhere. And I would have been willing to even lay a bet on it. But instead we get death by bat.
Yeah. I was hoping, that she was going to walk out onto a beach and be like, it's going to be carnage. And we're like, oh, shit. Yeah.
If that would make more sense if you knew the comics already. That would make a lot more sense. Also, why Woody Harrelson is wearing that crazy Wendy from Wendy's wig.
Raggedy Ann wig.
It is so goofy to me to talk about Venom for a moment. This is a movie that has already decided that Venom, a character whose sole existence is to get revenge on Spider-Man, does not need Spider-Man in his story, but Carnage does need to have curly red hair because that's what it's like in the comics. Even though he's played by a famously bald actor. Like, it's... Comics movies are done that way. So Doolittle. Dan?
Let's do our next segment that ties up the movie talk about Doolittle, and that is to decide final judgments whether it's a good, bad movie, a bad, bad movie, or a movie kind of like, guys, I'm not going to say it's a movie kind of like, but here's the thing. I come down where Elliot is, where he's like, I thought this was going to be a fiasco, and I was like, you know what? Whatever. Like, here's the thing. I think that this movie has a lot of problems, but it would not have been viewed as such a huge fiasco if it wasn't the movie that Robert Downey Jr. decided to make directly after his hugely successful run as Iron Man, Tony Stark. Like, it has problems, but it's making a stab at a kind of, like, high adventure children's thing that I like in general. Like, it doesn't have, like, the pop culture a minute references of a Sonic, and I kind of appreciate it for that. Like, if this movie was basically the same movie, but they made it animated, you know, pretty good. I don't know.
I mean, I kind of feel the same way, and I know that there's movies that I really liked as a kid that are no better than this movie. Like, and there are movies that people I know liked a lot from when we were kids, Goonies, that I think this is a better movie than, come at me and hate me on the internet, guys, I think it's a better movie than Goonies, but I'm curious, David, to hear what you're saying. Your experience in the theater was different, that you felt kind of like trapped with it.
Experience in the theater, it's, I will just, as I was saying, like, there's a lot of hasty editing and sort of strain, you know, cuts to the animals, like singles on the animals that are just sort of saying a joke that just suggests, like, whatever the initial concept was here, it's lost. Like, so there's instead, like, sort of several steps. There's the you know, dark, you know, he's a sad, depressed guy and his animals are sort of depressed too, and they all need to figure out how to weather emotional pain together. There's that through line. But then there's also the ripping high seas adventure, kids movie. And then there's the sort of, well, we got in a bunch of celebs to say funny stuff. Like, it just feels like there's a studio movie, there's the original director's movie, and then there's this sort of like salvage job, okay, Robert Downey Jr. movie. And I would take any of them and call it just a regular old bad movie that is perfectly entertaining for kids. Putting them all together makes it feel pretty like wince inducing. But I know what you guys are saying. The Downey thing really hurt it. Like the sort of like, oh, if people were sort of waiting, you know, they were smelling blood. They wanted a bomb just to ding him with.
Yeah, I kept seeing in reviews that point that Dan was saying that, like, this is the movie that Robert Downey Jr. decided to make, as if he owed it to the world to make – he owed it to each individual reviewer to make the movie they wanted to see him make.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I don't know, maybe he's always loved the Dr. Doolittle stories, or maybe he was like – I think his
company. What was that company, movie made? The rural juror or whatever? The judge?
The judge.
Oh, the judge.
Yeah, people want more of the judge.
Well, like, I mean, it was one of those movies where the trailers for it made it look like an even more of a mishmash than the movie was, because the trailers were done up as if it was like a big dramatic adventure movie, but then you'd have the quips from the animals, but with dramatic music over them. So it was like, who's made this trailer? What's going on? But I found myself kind of thinking it was going to be more of a disaster than it was. Stu, you're the tie-breaking vote here since
well, that's not
David gets three
correct.
Votes.
Okay. Because, it's 2-1 right now. I'm going to be on Team David here. I will give this movie a B-. That's right. Not enough Tony Banderas.
A B- still seems really generous.
No, that's very generous grade,
I'm just joking. No, I didn't like this movie at all. Worse than Sonic the Hedgehog, raves Stewart. Yeah, it's sloppy and it doesn't even seem to care that it's on there on the screen. It's, you know, it's barely a movie.
If you had this movie and you put Jim Carrey's performance from Sonic the Hedgehog in it as Dr. Doolittle, I'd be like, sure, yeah, I'll let my kids watch that any day of the week. Sure, that's fine.
It would at least have a sort of consistently manic energy in that. You know, there's two things that I found sort of Googling around. Is one, Robert Downey Jr. decided to be Welsh because of the famous Welsh, like, neo-druidic doctor guy from the Victorian era, William Price. Is someone that Robert Downey Jr. thinks is a cool dude, I guess, or is fascinating. So he's like,
he's
that'll
like an
be
actual
my vibe.
Dr. Doolittle, right? Like,
right. And like, that's
who,
a funny
idea. Who again
did
a lot of stuff. The name is not a good name, but anyway, yeah, you're saying good.
That, it's a funny idea, but not for this movie. Like, not, you know, it feels like he just had sort of a fun idea that does not relate to a movie about a farting dragon. But then.
I think it's a little unfair to call a movie about a farting dragon. The farting dragon is in one sequence.
The Hollywood Reporter sort of quote-unquote expose about like what went wrong with Doolittle said that Downey met up with the guy who was rewriting it, tore up the script's pages dramatically, said, I have some new ideas with a twinkle in his eye, and proposed the farting dragon conclusion. So I don't know what to believe. Like, did he want to make a weird Welsh doctor biopic, or did he want to make a farting dragon movie?
I mean, maybe he wasn't sure himself, you know?
This movie is a little unsure of itself, I would say.
Oh, to be a stick bug on the wall of that conversation.
Robert Downey Jr. to translate, and you'd be like, well, you could just be saying this, Robert Downey Jr. Like, I don't know if the stick bug really thinks that.
I mean, this is just a guess on my part, but I would assume that, like, the goofier shit in this movie was the stuff that was, quote-unquote, trying to save it.
Right,
and
I think there was
the original movie...
Right, was dark. There was a fear like, uh-oh, this isn't going to be a kid's movie that plays. We need to juice up the jokes.
That makes it, but I still like, it could have, I mean, I if anything, now I'm like, it doesn't fully work at the end of the day, but I like give them credit for trying to kid it up and lighten it up so that we didn't get a super dour Doolittle movie I'm trying to think what else would happen in it, where like he has to murder someone at the end, or like,
with a pillow, like, he just puts a pillow over Queen Victoria's face and cries and says, "I'm sorry."
He like turns his back on humanity, and the last you see of him is just naked wandering into a jungle to be with the animals.
I mean, I'm so much of it felt like that Robert Downey Jr. most likely came on set. He had this very low energy, kind of weird character that he had dreamt up, and nobody could talk him out of it. And they're just right. Like, oh, fuck it. Okay, let's
you
just
can't
get this
say
shot.
No. Right.
Like, we'll shoot it and then we'll fix it.
Yeah. That combined with Steven Gagan being like, yeah, we can do an emotional $200 million movie. And because he had Downey's backing, he was allowed to, with that caveat of like, well, you know what? We'll just do reshoots. Like, if it doesn't work, we'll just do reshoots.
I mean, I guess you can do a huge emotional blockbuster movie with Robert Downey Jr. in it. It's called Avengers Endgame. Boom. In theaters now.
Oh,
actually, it's not in theaters now. It's been out of theaters for a while, I guess.
And also, theaters are largely closed.
Don't go to theaters right now. Go again when it's time, when things have opened up. I guess what I'm saying is, don't.
What are you, a theater commercial right now?
Wasn't it nice when Avengers Endgame was out and there was no pandemic and we went to see movies and Robert Downey Jr. was in them and they were nice?
Back when he could do no wrong. So I guess, Dan, does this fit into our rubric at all? Should we try to give it ratings? Because mine is also some... I wouldn't quite call it a movie I kind of liked, but I don't think it's good, bad, or bad, bad. So.
Yeah, same here. But these guys think it's bad, bad. That's
I think
fine.
The bad, bads have it.
I don't know about that. I mean, oh, no, that's right. David gets extra votes, yeah.
Hey, Max Funsters, it's Jesse Thorne. This week on my public radio interview show, Bullseye, I'm talking with Tina Fey and Robert Carlock about creating Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, 30 Rock, and also just kind of why they're the best at everything.
There was a window of time when we used to go to awards things and pick up our prizes and party with the people from Mad Men.
You can find Bullseye at MaximumFun.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne.
All right, Adam, Maximum Fun wants us to record like a promo to tell people that they should listen to The Greatest Generation. You want to do that?
No, I am tired of all the extra work. I just wanted to talk about Star Trek with my friend.
I think it would be good to like try and get some new listeners by appealing to the audiences of other shows. Like this will only take a minute or two. It could be good for us.
We sit down for an hour every week and talk about a Star Trek episode and make a bunch of idiotic fart jokes about it. It's embarrassing. If it got out that we made this show, I think it would make us unemployable.
Adam, I have bad news for you. We have tens of thousands of listeners at MaximumFun.org.
Oh, my God. I think I'm going to throw up.
The Greatest Generation, a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. Every Monday on MaximumFun.org.
I'm really going to be sick.
The Flophouse is sponsored in part by Squarespace, the service that allows you to turn your cool idea into a new website, blog, or publish content, sell products and services of all kinds, and more. And they do this by giving you beautiful customizable templates created by world-class designers with everything optimized for mobile right out of the box. Your site will look great on all sorts of devices. A new way to buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions, free and secure hosting. So if you're looking to make a website with Squarespace, head to squarespace.com/flop for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code FLOP to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Dan, just very briefly, I had a website I was actually wondering if Squarespace would be able to help me with.
Sure. Ask away.
I was inspired by this movie. I have an idea for a website. It's called www.doless.com. The only website that will match you up with an animal that will do your chores for you so you don't have to do as much. Look, we are all doing too much these days. I know I'm taking care of two kids, holding down a job, and trying to finish a jigsaw puzzle. It is a nightmare. If only I could hire a hedgehog to finish that jigsaw puzzle or watch my children for me. Welcome to DoLess.com, the only website that matches you up with an animal that can do that stuff for you. Dan, is there anything going on in your life that you wish that like a lemur or a slow loris or a cassowary could take care of?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of dishes that a lot more cooking at home. Dishes pile up. Laundry, because I'm trying to wear actual clothes every day so I don't slip into depression. Those things would be great. I found it interesting that you wanted your animal to possibly do the jigsaw puzzle for you, which it seems like the recreational thing that you listed.
Dan, all I'm saying is I've got too much on my plate, and this animal's got to take something off my plate. If that means eating my dinner for me off a plate, then go ahead, aardvark, do it. So, Dan, I think maybe you're looking for, like, I don't know, like a salamander or perhaps a like a mockingbird who'll do that laundry for you. And let me just put that into doless.com. Boop, 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 boop. That's the sound it makes when you put it in. And it looks like there are squirrels in your area that will be happy to wash your dishes for you. Now, again, doless.com, let me just get the legal stuff out of the way. Doless.com cannot guarantee that these animals will do the job well, and we are not legally liable if they break anything or soil anything in your apartment or house. But look, we're just a middleman. We're not legally liable. We're just here to connect you with the animals that want to do those jobs. Think of it like TaskRabbit with actual rabbits. Doless.com.
Oh, now, Snow White, notwithstanding, which I have been rewatching because I've been reading a Disney biography. I don't think that squirrels have the body strength to do the things that you are assigning them.
I'm not assigning anyone anything. Dan, you put
I think I've written a book that can lift like 10 times their body weight.
Yeah, yeah.
Or wait, am I thinking of ants?
Ants. Oh, you're thinking of.
But maybe
what did he say? What did he say?
Squirrels.
Oh, okay. They sound alike.
They do sound very similar. Dan, I'm not assigning them anything. You put your job on the website. Animals offer to do it for you. You pay them in acorns or whatever. Just stop putting this on me. Not legally liable. I'm just the middleman. That's doless.com. Okay, let's move on. Just trying to promote my new website that I hope Squarespace can help me with, and you got to start telling me it doesn't work, and you haven't even tried it yet.
All right.
Okay, I think the next part of this podcast is the Jumbotrons. That's where you tell us something to say. And in this case, what I am saying is, I am a freelance graphic illustrator who specializes in fantasy and sci-fi portraits. My pieces make great gifts for anyone who likes tabletop, fantasy, video games, or their own special fandom. Just visit illustration.com to check out my commission work. Now, I need to clarify the spelling of this. This URL is illustration.com. And I just checked it out, and it's really great. And you'll see some familiar faces in the commission work, including some of our friends over at the Adventure Zone. And I'm assuming Dan gave me this Jumbotron to read because out of all of us, I'm the only one who has commissioned a portrait of one of their role-playing game characters from an artist. Now, that's just a guess. I don't want to sully you guys. I don't want to paint you guys with a brush, but... Is that true? Have you any of your favorite role-playing game characters, have you paid to have them drawn by an artist?
Stuart, I have essentially one role-playing game character.
Okay.
You know him. The only art that's been done has been done by listeners. It's not I did not commission anything.
I recently hired someone to
I'm just saying maybe this will give you the opportunity to get that character drawn over at illustration.com.
Okay. Well, I will not continue my story because it would have been pointless because I've got another Jumbotron. This is a message for Jen, last name withheld, and it is from Kevin, last name withheld. And the message goes like this. Happy birthday to the most amazing, sweetest, most beautiful love of my life. There's nobody I'd rather be trapped indoors with, and especially nobody I'd rather be sharing the world and my life with. I love you with all of my heart and all of my other guts, too, and promise you an unlimited amount of face bonks and ghost kisses forever. So that's for Jen from Kevin. How sweet. That's really lovely. Do you guys have any stories about love that you want to share?
No.
Okay, then let's move on to, we got one final thing to promote. Flophouse listeners, have you ever wondered what it would be like to see a live Flophouse show in your very own home and maybe the hosts haven't showered and are wearing pajamas or haven't shaved recently? I don't know. Look, there's a lot going on and we're not taking good care of ourselves. Well, here's your chance. June 6th at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, we are going to be doing a live over-the-computer Flophouse talking about something show. We're going to put up a link at theflophousepodcast.com where you can find out where to go to see it. We're still working out the tech details. That's right. The Flophouse boys are bringing their patented brand of don't really know what we're doing, but we're going to try it anyway to live online shows. Guys, Is this going to be with, like, presentations before it, just like a regular live show in person would have?
Yeah, we're going to have our usual comedy PowerPoint presentations. I mean, this is going to be as close to a live show as we could do over Zoom. So people who have seen a live show can enjoy one from the comfort of their home. But people who, you know, don't live where we've come before, this is your chance to get that experience or close to it.
Guys, uh-huh. are we going
to
talk about...
Without having to commit to, like, leaving your home to do it, now you'll realize whether or not we're just going to waste your evening.
You'll know that you never have to leave your home again to see us. Guys, are we going to talk about Howard the Duck, the movie that introduced the world to the idea of ducks with boobs, which they wouldn't need because ducks don't bear live young, they lay eggs?
that's correct, Elliot. Good point.
And guys, are we going to do this for a charity yet to be determined, because the three of us have not yet been able to agree on a charity to do it for?
That is correct. It will be free to watch. However, throughout, we will be encouraging donations to charity. We will have a place to send folks, and we will have some sort of raffle.
Yeah,
offering
some kind of prizes, like this prize I keep threatening, where we're going to set up a website called Only Dan Fans, where if you're a fan of Dan's, you can come and we'll just see pictures of Dan, maybe chat, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, my son would love that. He's a big fan of Dan. Not me, though. So that's June 6th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific. And just go to theflophousepodcast.com for more information about where and how to see it.
Okay, so let's move on to letters from listeners. Listeners like you.
Ba-da-ba, it's a long show, don't have time for a song. Doolittle letters.
This first letter is from James, last name withheld, who writes...
Corden, James Corden.
Elliot mentioned The Lighthouse was surprisingly relatable in this time of isolations. But is it the best thing to watch? There's some things I can't go to the CDC for, so I come to you. What's the best thing to watch now? Something similarly isolating? Something totally freeing with crowds and normal life? Something that can uncomfortably enmesh itself into my now fragile psyche, sending me into a downward spiral of an unending fever dream trapped in repetition with no end in sight? I hope you can help us make sense of life in the way you always do, with film. Sincerely, James, last name withheld. It's weird. I, during quarantine, have been going in two opposite directions. I have either watched things that sort of echo life as it is right now in interesting ways, or I have gone for total lightness. I think that the one thing I can't stand right now as much as I could maybe is something that takes a lot of intellectual or emotional energy from me. But
like,
you know,
Sonic.
I watched... Yes, like Sonic. But I watched, like, a movie called, what was it called? Await Further Instructions, which is about a family trapped inside during a disaster that they know very little about. And there's themes of scapegoating, racial scapegoating, like stuff. Oh, yeah, there's a authoritarian but not very bright, perhaps, father character who sways people very easily. Like, there are uncanny parallels to life right now, and I kind of enjoyed it for that in a grim way. And then on the other side of things, I've been watching, like, I don't know, Audrey Hepburn musicals and rewatching 30 Rock. So I think both are good ways to go. How have you guys been choosing your entertainments right now?
Just speaking for myself, I've been watching a lot of some light things. But also, and I've been watching Newsies over and over again because that's what Sammy wants to watch. So if you look at the pie chart of movies watched over the quarantine, like fully 35% of it is just Newsies. But at the same time, I don't know. I think I'm trying to achieve a sort of normalcy by just watching the things I would normally watch. You know, during our Last Blood episode, I remembered that I hadn't watched a lot of Japanese movies in a while, and so I've been watching a bunch of Japanese movies that I have on my cable box. I've been trying to just kind of like make a little pocket of normal for myself where I just watch the movies that I would be watching if nothing else was going on. But that's just my one way of coping with it. Stu, David, what have you been watching?
Well, I've been watching a lot of TV with Charlene. We've been doing a, well, it's a rewatch for her, but we're watching The Shield, early 2000s FX, Michael Chiklis, police, I guess, procedural. And it was kind of like, it was pretty important when it was originally released. And I'm assuming it was important because the fashion choices are incredible. And like every other episode begins with like a sad Alice in Chains song. But it's great. I like it a lot. And we're punctuating that with weekly, releases of the What We Do in the Shadows TV show, which is the best television show currently on. So watch that if you haven't.
Yeah, I've been all over the place. We did watch the entirety of The OC, me and my partner, so it's not like I'm not binging old TV that I enjoyed when I was young and fancy free. But I've been wavering between like watching sort of comfortable classics that I enjoy and trying to like knock off, you know, things on my Criterion watch list, you know, trying to fill in gaps, you know, take advantage of the time. I wrote a piece on The Atlantic about Westerns. I had a whole like couple weeks where all I watched was Westerns just because I wanted stuff that was set outside, like anything with like vistas and sweeping landscapes was sort of doing it for me. That was probably the most fun phase.
So like Wild Wild West.
Wild Wild West, and then
yeah, Lone Ranger.
You know,
sure.
I mean, yeah, Lone Ranger,
Maverick.
2011. No, like a lot of old class, you know, Red River, Rio Bravo, things like that. Like just, you know, just fun stuff.
I will find watching movies, I'm being not triggered is the wrong word, but like kind of shocked by little things that I didn't expect to. Like Dan, my wife and I are in the middle of watching a movie you recommended a while ago, The Best Worst Thing That Ever Happened, right?
Oh,
the one about
a great movie.
About Merrily We Roll Along. And there's the part that's weird about seeing like a theater full of people watching a play, but it's even weirder to see television news covering a play in previews that is having trouble with its production and being like, oh, the news used to cover stuff that wasn't like the end of the world. Like the news would sometimes cover that these famous people are making a play and it's a musical and it's not going great. And like, it was just, that was the most shocking thing to me, but in a nice way.
I was just watching, that underwater movie, the monster movie set underwater.
Absolutely.
And, there's some stuff in it that I really like, and, all the interiors are great, but specifically when they're like walking around in these like cool robo suits underwater, and you're like kind of trapped inside this little shell with the actors, that stuff's all really great. And it was kind of more affecting for me. But yeah, and then the movie had to, we'll pull back and you'll get this big sweeping vista with Marvel style Chirons and you're like, oh, that's not as good.
I enjoyed Underwater. I like it when a movie doesn't have a first act. I'm always a fan of no first act movies.
Yeah, it throws you right in it.
Yeah,
and,
it's basically,
and also,
so we're underwater. Oh no, the whole thing exploded. Like that's the beginning of the movie.
Like, well, like a lot of times,
I guess we'll
like
introduce ourselves while we deal with this. Hi, folks. See you later.
Well, normally a movie like that would explain, like, oh, let's spend the first third of the movie explaining why this thing is so important and, like, why it'll never explode later on.
How it works and right, yeah.
No, you just want to see it explode. That's all I'm here for.
Well, that's funny. It's funny how movies will get complimented for opposite things. Like, I feel like I've seen so many reviews where they're like, the great thing about this movie is it really takes its time and explains who the characters are before the action happens. And other reviews were like, the best thing about this movie is it really gets into the action right away and doesn't waste time explaining all the characters. And it's like, wait a minute. I guess it's whether they do it well or not.
Yeah. There's always the reviewer who's like, I wish they'd spent more time explaining who the babysitter was before she died and Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead.
Well, talked about my gritty reboot of Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. When are we going to finally tell the babysitter's story? So it ends with her getting to the house. So you know it's like a Joker-style thing where the movie ends just as the character becomes remotely interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, yeah.
No, I was just imagining a much like grimmer version of Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead Now, where they like put her in one of those like those big freezers in the garage, and they like have to do all this. I don't know, like they fear that they're going to be suspected by the murder, you know.
Yeah, and the youngest kid thinks that the body is talking to him, and his psyche is breaking down. Yeah.
Yeah.
Babysitter anyway, of the Flies, we call it.
This second and final letter is from, I believe, I'm going to try and pronounce this Kier. I don't know. It's K-I-R-E. Apologies if I'm doing it wrong. But Kier writes, "Hi, I'm a Toronto filmmaker, and my new feature, The Last Porno Show, just premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival. I just listened to your latest podcast on The Joke Thief. Thought it was great. A little story about The Joke Thief. Apparently, the script was 10 pages.
One of the I mean, apparently, that makes perfect sense.
One of the actors told me the script consisted of a few scenes and a bunch of spots where it just said, scene will be added here, which I believe. I've had to transcribe three of Frank's scripts. Oh, Frank writes his scripts by talking into a voice recorder until he's bored, and whatever he comes up with is the film. There's no revisions. It's fucking insane. The reason why I'm reaching out is because I'm Frank's second largest fan, the first being himself. I've been obsessed with him for years, so much so that I cast him in my film. Not only is this the first time Frank has acted in someone else's film, but it's the first and only time he got invited to TIFF. He plays a method acting teacher in my film, and it's easily the best acting he's ever done. Aside from casting Frank in my film, I've had the fortune/misfortune of helping him on his own films, easily the most stressful thing I've ever put myself through. I could go on for days, but just to give you an idea, we shot his two new feature films in 2.5 days, and one of them is a hockey film. Kier promotes their movie, The Last Porno Show. I can't, you know, speak to its quality, but, you know, it has a couple reviews online. Seems like it got pretty good reviews. And you can see Frank D'Angelo in a different film, not directed by himself.
That's amazing. David, are you familiar with the works of Frank D'Angelo?
I mean, familiar in that I know... I've never actually put myself through them. Do you think should? Do you think it's like, you know, a nice quarantine project for me?
The Atlantic is looking for articles, right?
It's true. I mean, you got to make content about something.
No, I mean, I guess you could just go to the theaters and write about what's playing there. Oh, hold on a second. Yeah, it looks like Frank D'Angelo is your new best friend.
I mean, a movie called The Wretched has been the number one movie 2 weeks in a row at the box office. It's playing in like some drive-ins in Florida.
I think No Deposit is probably worth watching, okay. Right?
Noted.
Yeah, that one's that's closest the one to an actual movie, and while still being like amusingly bad. It is a trend downward.
Yeah, don't see The Joke Thief. And Sicilian Vampire is only worth it for the scene where James Caan asks him to bite him so that he can make him into a vampire, and doesn't seem to think there's anything weird about that.
It does sound pretty good, but I'm seeing here that No Deposit is 80 minutes to Sicilian Vampire's 124. So I think I'm going to go with No Deposit.
No Deposit does have two of the best lines in cinema history, and I won't tell you what they are.
Do not spoil them.
Let's just say Frank Langella, not Frank Langella, says, Robert Loggia says one of them.
Yeah.
Frank Langella. Another big endorsement. If only he could have been in a Frank D'Angelo movie.
Robert Loggia's last role, right?
I believe it is, yes. Yeah. Frank D'Angelo specializes in giving famous actors their last roles.
It's true.
Every one of his movies doubles as a last known photo for a former Hollywood star.
Yeah. Okay, so guys, time for our final segment, and that is recommendations of movies that you should watch, probably instead of Doolittle, unless, I don't know, you're like a 7-year-old, in which case you shouldn't be listening to this show.
Not at all.
I'm going to recommend a movie that we watched just recently. Audrey is a big fan of Henri-Georges Clouzot, but has not seen... you know, several of the movies, and she was interested in The Wages of Fear, which is one of my favorite movies, but I was like, no, not 2.5 hours of that tonight. Let's watch this movie that neither of us had seen that was 90 minutes called Le Corbeau.
Oh, The Raven.
The Raven, yes. And it's about there's a doctor in a small town who becomes the target of some poison pen letters, and then sort of everyone in the town becomes the target of these letters all signed by the Raven, and it creates chaos. No one knows who it is. It's he's talked of as the French Hitchcock. This movie is kind of right at the corner of Hitchcock and film noir avenues, with a lot of Frenchness thrown in, and it's sort of a thriller, sort of just a drama about the way mobs can tear things apart, and it's also it was banned for a while. It has like very frank talk about abortion and sexuality in it for a movie that was made in 1943. And I think it's kind of interesting too, because it feels absolutely no need to make its protagonist likable in any way, which makes it very easy to sort of like suspect everyone in the film of some sort of wrongdoing. But it's like I said, 90 minutes. It's on Criterion. We liked it a lot.
Stuart, what you got?
Oh, I will recommend the recently released on HBO Bad Education. Starring everybody's favorite jacked man, Hugh Jackman, Ray Romano, Allison Janney. It's the
every
second
time
movie.
Someone says Allison Janney, I think they're going to say Alice in Chains. Every single time.
That experience right now.
Hey, nah, nah, nah. So
sure, look up Allison Janney on your metal website.
Yeah, metal archive.
Let's just give me a second.
Just known for one recording of The Jackal.
Wow, it's so it says no results. It's the second movie directed by the Corey Finley, who directed Thoroughbreds, and it's this great thriller based on an article, which is based on a true story about Long Island superintendent who had been skimming money from the district, and it's this thriller about corruption that slowly reveals the story in such a careful and specific way, so that you are kind of dragged along, like this conspiracy slowly unfolds for you, the viewer, almost just like it does for the characters in the movie. It's really great. And in a time when there's not a lot of new stuff coming out, it's a real gem. So if you get a chance, check it out.
I am going to recommend a movie. I mentioned earlier that I am watching more Japanese movies because I realized I haven't seen a Japanese movie in a while. And I finally got to see Floating Weeds. That's right, Floating Weeds. It's an Ozu movie starring Denjiro Nakamura and Michiko Kyo. Yes, that's right, that Michiko Kyo from Gate of Hell and Ugetsu Monogatari, one of my favorites. And this is the 1959 version. This is a story that Ozu told twice. This is the version that's in color and with sound, and it's the story of this kind of pretty low-rent acting troupe that shows up in a small seaside town for a run of shows of old-fashioned kind of kabuki-style drama. And in that town, unbeknownst to almost everybody else, the head of the acting troupe has an illegitimate son and an ex-lover, and the son does not know that it's his father. He thinks that this is his uncle who shows up every, 12 years or so. Hasn't been there a long time, and it's about what happens when that secret starts to come out. And the movie is told, like a lot of Ozu movies, very like deceptively simply and deceptively slowly, but it's a beautiful looking movie. And he's one of those directors where when I was young, I wasn't quite on the right wavelength for it. But now that I'm older, I really love the way that he just photographs things and the way that he lets the stories play out. And so I thought it was really great. And it has comedy moments. It's got heavy dramatic moments. And the acting's really great in it. It's called Floating Weeds.
David?
Love Floating Weeds. I will recommend Mid-August Lunch, which is a little Italian movie from 2008. I interviewed Barry Jenkins for The Atlantic a couple weeks ago, just asking him, like, hey, what are you watching? Like, because, again, got to write about something. And this was a movie he recommended to me that I had never even heard of. It's by Gianni De Gregorio. And he said he'd seen it at a film festival and he sort of vaguely remembered it. And he was thinking about Italy a lot, about the sort of small towns in Italy and the older population because of what was going on in the world. And he flipped on this. I think it's 80 minute sort of like sweet, sad little comedy about a guy who starts looking after everyone's cranky relatives in his town when they all want to go on vacation in August. And it kind of is just one of those like clever little comedies that creeps up on you, like a real sense of place, real sense of character. Gianni De Gregorio. It's on Amazon, mid-August launch.
Great. Okay, well, we've come to the end of this marathon. David.
Yes.
Do you have anything you want to plug?
You know, Blank Check with Griffin and David, my podcast. We take directors who were given a blank check by Hollywood at some point in their careers, you know, to make some kind of insane passion project-y movie. And we go through their whole filmography up and down. You guys were on the Manchurian Candidate episode for our Demi miniseries recently.
Well, that was fun.
We're just wrapping up George Miller now, and, you know.
Oh, has he made any good movies?
Does he have one of the wildest filmographies of a blockbuster director? Yes. Yes, he does. Enjoy that.
It's such a good show. I think I've alarmed Griffin and David by tweeting too much about how I've been listening.
No, I am unalarmable.
Okay, good. Audrey, like, came out of the room once and being like, am I just going to hear David Sims and Griffin Newman all quarantine? I'm like, hey, man.
Hell yeah.
It's making me feel good. It's comforting me during this time. So check it out, I say.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You said we'd be listening to more Allison Janney if she had a longer metal discography, but I guess that's not happening.
Yeah.
So, guys, that's it. You know, check out the other shows at the Maximum Fun network, MaximumFun.org.
Uh-huh.
Stay safe, wear a mask, be good to each other, all that stuff.
Yep.
And for the Flophouse, I've been Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
I'm Ellie Kalin.
David is David.
I'm David Sims.
This is the kind of thing that we're supposed to tell our guests that they're going to do at the end of the episode.
I was 80% sure I was supposed to say something, but I was.
What I like is I have to assume there was a voice in the back of your mind that was like, if I'm not supposed to say something and I introduce myself at the end, they'll yell at me, so I better not do it.
Yeah.
We're pretty mean. Anyway, bye, everyone. I don't know why you feel the need to interrupt my kind invitation for socializing for a neighbor, but...
Consider it revenge for when you interrupted me thanking him for being on the show.
Okay.
So yeah, there's like 2 hours of this shit you're gonna...
This is the kind of energy.
Very excited.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.